comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there goes the Spider-Man.
Hello and welcome back to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
We are going to take a trip back in time to June 1962 when the Marvel comics that were cover dated August 1962 were on the stands. And we are not actually going to be talking about that many pages this week.
Or the Fantastic Four, weirdly.
Yeah, the Fantastic Four and Hulk were both still on a bi-monthly publishing schedule, so... we will pick them up again next week on the podcast, but we have a couple of pretty awesome debuts this week.
A couple of people you may have heard of.
Yeah, so the first issue we're going to talk about is Journey into Mystery, number 83, or at least the first story in Journey into Mystery 83. It's the first appearance of the Mighty Thor.
God of Thunder.
And the second issue we're going to get to is Amazing Adult Fantasy, which I think by this point they had dropped the adult.
It's just weird.
It's just, even then it had to sound creepy, right? Amazing Fantasy number 15, which is the first appearance of a little known character named Spider-Man. So I'm super excited to talk about both of these stories. I think, you know, these are obviously two core characters in the Marvel Universe. One of them, I think, is probably about as good as superhero comics ever get.
I agree. Yeah. And certainly became the icon for the entire Marvel universe for years.
Yeah, basically. If for not decades. Still to this day. Yeah. But before we get into all that, let's just talk a little bit about what was going on in June 1962. So appropriately enough, there are two events in June 1962, one on June 4th and one on June 19th, where America attempts to detonate a nuclear weapon 40 miles above the Earth out in outer space. And both of these tests were unsuccessful. So we're mentioning not only because of the fears of nuclear war and radiation that come into Marvel Comics of the time, but also the fact that this missile... It was called the Thor missile. Let's see, what else? Also, sort of a science-y radiation tie-in on June 18th. The first cosmic X-ray source was discovered by mankind. It was found by instruments on an Aerobee rocket, and it was called Scorpius X-1, which...
Everything sounds like a sweet science fiction movie from the 50s. It's so cool.
It really, really does. the Fantastic Four, of course, were turned into superheroes thanks to cosmic rays, and for the first time... Real-world scientists found the source of cosmic X-rays. So there you go.
Oh, we should mention.
Oh, yeah.
June 12th.
Yes.
3 days before his high school graduation, 18-year-old George Lucas, little-known figure in, you know, science fiction and fantasy, as mm-hmm. well as filmmaking in general.
And future fellow Disney acquisition.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about it in this time in our future of in the future of 1960, George Lucas is going to be instrumental in making sure all of these figures can come to life on the silver screen. So he survived a near fatal car crash caused by a fellow student. So his ambition and dream to become a race car driver was quashed. And lucky for all of us, he decided to become a filmmaker instead, except for Jar Jar. Sorry.
That's, no one bats a thousand, I guess. So there you go. That's just a sampling of what was going on in June 1962, in addition to, you know, all of the Cold War shenanigans. Let's just go ahead and jump into, let's take on Journey into Mystery 83 first. Let's talk about Thor. This first Thor story was, how do they credit Stan? Was it concept by or plot by or something like that?
I can't.
So Stan Lee gets the plotting credit. His brother Larry Lieber was the actual scripter, And then Jack Kirby was the artist. So all three men are credited as co-creators for Thor. And for anyone who has followed Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's, you know, individual and mutual relationships over the years, you might be unsurprised to hear that they each have very different opinions on how Thor came to be.
Yeah, Stan thinks, of course, that he created Thor by trying to think of how you make someone stronger than the strongest person. You make them a god, or you, you know, make a god come to life in this universe. So he felt like delving into Norse legends would be better, since their Greek and Roman had already been, or hadn't dropped out of popular culture, I should say. So that's what he chose to pick. And that is how he recollects it.
Yes. Kirby, this is from a 1984 interview that he did. His version of the story goes like this. I did a version of Thor for DC in the 50s before I did him for Marvel. I created Thor at Marvel because I was forever enamored of legends, which is why I knew about Baldur, Heimdall, and Odin. I tried to update Thor and put him into a superhero costume, but he was still Thor. Later on in an interview a few years later, Kirby said, I knew the Thor legends very well, but I wanted to modernize them. I felt that might be a new thing for comics, taking the old legends and modernizing them. Which, of course, Kirby does, you know, takes one step further toward that in the 70s when he creates the new gods for DC.
Creates, his own pantheon.
Yeah, just bursting out of his head. But yeah, so you talk to Stan and he says he came up with the idea of, you know, making a super powerful god as the greatest hero of all. Jack says, hey, I was already doing this for DC before I came back to Marvel. The truth probably lies somewhere in between.
As it often does.
As it often does. Let's jump into Journey into Mystery 83. And first of all, take a look at that cover. Which is classic Kirby. You've got Thor striking a dramatic pose, whipping his hammer around.
Green rock men jump out of a Flash Gordon-style spaceship.
And he's billed as the most exciting superhero of all time. Does that live up to the hype? Let's see.
Maybe not straight out of the gate, but let's find out. Thor the Mighty and the Stone Men from Saturn.
Yeah, so we open on a giant splash page of Thor holding his Uru hammer, Mjolnir. Again, a very dramatic Kirby pose. The legend has come true. By the will of the gods, I am alive. I am invincible. I am Thor. And our story begins on the windy coast of Norway, where we see a frail man leaning on a cane. He is Dr. Don Blake, an American who's vacationing in Europe.
And instantly, before we even get off the first page, we see a spaceship landing behind him. So we're not, you know, dilly-dallying in getting into the story here.
And out of the spaceship, as it lands, come several of the aforementioned stone men from Saturn, which basically look like the Thing with, like, Easter Island heads.
Definitely. That's not basically. They look exactly like the Thing with Easter Island heads.
And they spend a few panels showing off their strength and invincibility. One rips a tree out of the ground. Another one leaps off a cliff just for kicks. Another one disintegrates yet another tree with his blaster pistol. An old Norwegian fisherman is observing them from the rocks. And he runs back into town to try to spread the word about these alien invaders.
And, of course, the townspeople think he's a nut. So no one believes him. He can't convince them. But Dr. Don Blake does believe him. So he decides he's going to go try to find out more about this on his own. The next day, he takes his frail body and his cane and goes hiking along the harsh Norwegian coast.
And for a guy who's kind of limited with his mobility, he does a pretty good job climbing over this rocky coastline. Unfortunately, he clumsily snaps a twig, alerts the aliens to his presence, and they start pursuing him.
he drops his cane. So he has to basically scrabble up some rocks and finds a cave to hide in.
Yes. And as he's starting to succumb to despair, he accidentally hits a lever to open a hidden passageway in the cave. And inside the hidden passage is a gnarled walking cane just lying there, which is, you know, good luck if you have just lost your cane and you could really use one.
So he detects that there might be a way to escape out the back of this cave. So he starts trying to use this gnarled cane as a lever to move some rocks. And no matter what he does, he can't budge it. He becomes very frustrated and smacks the rock with the cane.
And this triggers an amazing transformation. And the cane changes into a stone hammer. And Dr. Don Blake transforms into the Norse thunder god Thor.
And one of two panels on page five here are the transformation. It's again just classic awesome Kirby, like showing somebody transform through lightning. It's just the body is composed of like black rectangles flying into a silhouetted bright light of blue. It's amazing that he can do this, and you can feel the electricity. But it's, you know, two little panels. He's just doing little, you know, basically six panel setups on these pages. So we do now have the hammer that we all know. It says on it, whosoever holds this hammer, if he be worthy, shall possess the power of Thor.
Yeah, and something that's interesting, if you're familiar with the character of Thor, is that later on, it's pretty clear that Dr. Don Blake and Thor are two very different people. But in this, it really seems like Blake has just been transformed and given the body of a god, but still very much has his own personality. He seems shocked and surprised and delighted to realize that he is now Thor. But he refers to Thor in the third person. So he talks about, you know, having his hammer. So, yeah, it's an interesting note.
He's not a conduit for the god at this point. He is just the mind riding around in the god body.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So with the power of Thor, he lifts the boulder that was blocking his exit, escapes from the cave, and then takes a moment to rest and consider everything that's happened, and then spontaneously changes back into Dr. Don Blake. He puts two and two together and realizes that he only has the power of Thor as long as he's holding the hammer, because the hammer is what gives him the power of Thor. So if he goes about a minute without touching it, he reverts back. So he turns back into Thor, because who wouldn't? And then spends a good page and a half
figuring out how everything works.
Yeah, it's an interesting creative decision. But he realizes he can throw the hammer, and it will fly back to him. The hammer is invincible. He can smash pretty much anything with it. He can stamp the handle of the hammer twice on the ground to create rain or snow and turn it into a tornado. And he can end the storm by stamping it three times on the ground. It's just, it's like he's like reading out of an instruction manual. It's like, right. Welcome to your Thor powers.
And I'd like to think that, I mean, they could have taken like four more pages to just have him experiment with things. Like if you hit it four times on the ground, you know, what happens? Does it make everyone experience a brown note or something? But I'm sure it happened. It's just, you know, off panel.
Sure. Exactly. So he decides that he's got to use his fantastic power to warn the world of the presence of the stone men. Speaking of those stone men,
they are getting ready to attack.
They certainly are. They are flying in formation, and NATO scrambles a squad in response to them. But they are driven away by the illusion of a giant flying dragon-like thing.
Seems like a great Kirby's excuse to draw a giant crazy-looking dragon.
Exactly. I think he had it in his contract that he had to be able to draw like at least two or three amazing absurd monsters per issue, or, you know, he is walking off the job.
That might have been like his deal with the devil to, you know, he had to do it.
Yes.
So the NATO forces all bail out of their planes, and then the fleet comes flying through the hologram, whatever, the 3D projected dragon. They shoot missiles at the ship. They have force fields. The missiles are all destroyed. Again, missiles, a common theme in this time.
Yes.
And Don, he decides he needs to become Thor and stop this. He has the power. The God of Thunder can stop them.
And he certainly does. He shows up where the stone men from Saturn land, knocks him around with his hammer a little bit. They drop a thick steel cage on him, which he just bends into smithereens, pulls himself out of, whacks him some more with the hammer, disarms them with a well-placed throw, and then they unleash a giant robot.
A giant robot with like a toothy maw. He's just he looks like a quintessential smasher of a robot.
Thor makes very short work of this robot, which just freaks out the stone men. They have decided that not only is Thor way too powerful for them, they have no idea how many more heroes like Thor there might be on this planet. And so they all get back into their ships and they fly off. The NATO forces arrive just in time to see them all retreating. And Blake decides that
he needs to switch back.
Yes, because he doesn't want to become an international curiosity. So he taps the hammer on the ground, turns back into lame Dr. Don Blake. And now he's going to head back to the States, and he's going to take with him the greatest power ever known to mortal man. The end. And it does follow up with an editor's note. Thor, spelled with two R's.
Whoops.
Whoops. The mighty, the greatest new superhero of all time, will appear regularly in Journey into Mystery. And that's true. Going forward, Journey into Mystery would become Thor's book, and then would eventually be renamed The Mighty Thor. So let's go ahead now and jump over to Amazing Fantasy. The cover of this is pretty awesome. We were talking about how much I liked this last week, but it is a Jack Kirby cover with Steve Ditko inking, and it shows Spider-Man in a very heroic pose, holding a criminal as he swings on his web, and he vows that although the world may mock Peter Parker, the timid teenager, it will soon marvel at the awesome might of Spider-Man.
I think this pose has been lampooned and in any number of ways. I have a signed comic of Stephen Colbert in this pose.
Nice.
doing this cover shot. It's just, it is so heroic and iconic. There is this marked difference from the Kirby version of Spider-Man you see on the cover. We get to the first page and you see Spider-Man and this little weird looking guy up in the right hand corner. It's so Ditko. He's like more spindly and a little creepy and a little more, you know, paranoia or something in the way he comes across.
Yeah. I mean, he looks deflated. He looks like he's probably like a buck 40 soaking wet. And the very first glimpse we get of him, he's being laughed at by a bunch of fellow high schoolers who are just having a grand old time, yucking it up and making fun of poor Peter Parker.
Then we get a glimpse into Peter's home life. So it starts out with, as you may have gathered, Peter Parker was far from being the biggest man on campus, but his Uncle Ben thought he was a pretty special lad. And that just sets up his family life so well.
Yeah. And it's just a really cute scene of his uncle waking him up by tussling his hair. He comes downstairs for breakfast where Aunt May has cooked his favorite breakfast, wheat cakes.
He's such a just sort of quintessentially nerdy guy.
Yeah.
And he's super excited to get to science class. You know, that's what he does. He's a hardworking honor student.
But he is not super popular with the ladies. We see him trying to invite Sally out to do something that evening, and she says that he's just not her type, not when dreamboats like Flash Thompson are around. And cue Flash Thompson entering in, pushing Peter Parker backward. And also worth noting, Flash Thompson is wearing a sweater with a giant embroidered T on the front of it. It's not the school logo because that's Midtown High. So he's wearing a giant embroidered letter of his own name on his shirt.
Yep.
Which tells you basically everything you need to know about Flash Thompson.
But Peter decides to persist. Mm-hmm. And he says, there's a great new exhibit at the Science Hall tonight. Would any of you like to go with me?
He's determined, but again, you know, no takers. He's pretty upset. He vows that someday they'll be sorry. Sorry that they laughed at him. And so he heads to a science exhibit, which is showing off some experiments in radioactivity. And I think we all know what happens next. If you haven't seen this in one form or another, you've probably, you know, never opened a comic book or watched a superhero movie. As Peter is watching this display of radioactivity, a spider drops down into the middle of the experiment, gets irradiated, lands on Peter's hand and bites him, which causes Peter to immediately start feeling woozy and leave the exhibit.
And as he's wandering around, feeling out of sorts, strange, he feels like his entire body is charged with some sort of fantastic energy.
And as he almost gets run over by a car, he leaps up into the air in surprise and probably jumps about 8 feet up on a wall, much to the delight and astonishment of the people driving.
And they just cruised around the corner, so they don't see him just stick to the wall and continue to climb. And he said he's scaling this wall just as easily as I can walk.
Yes, the only person who sees him climbing up the wall is a little boy who tries to point Peter out to his mother, and she just tells him that that's the last horror movie she's taking him to. Which, this kid does not look like he's more than 6 years old, so maybe his mom shouldn't be taking him to any horror movies.
True.
I'm just going to say.
Bad mom. So Peter also discovers that as he reaches the roof, he grabs a pipe to pull himself up over the edge, and he just crushes it like it was paper. So he has enormous strength.
And agility, too. He climbs down a cable, just like a spider walking down its web. He decides he's got to think and figure out what he can do with all of these amazing abilities that fate has granted to him.
A few minutes later. I love that.
It's so good. It's like, does not take him long to figure out what he's going to do. He's going to win $100 by getting into the ring and staying there for 3 minutes with Crusher Hogan.
Wrestling time.
He doesn't want to embarrass himself if he winds up losing. So he takes off his glasses, puts on a mask and some concealing clothes, and gets into the ring with Crusher Hogan, who obviously does not take him seriously. Crusher's got to be at least twice the size of Peter.
At least, maybe three times.
Yeah.
And but instantly, Peter jumps over him and then picks him up and climbs a very high turnbuckle and actually scares him by pulling him up there. So he's Crusher's now begging him to put him down and saying, you win, and that he's not human. Nobody can do that.
And the crowd is going wild. There's a fellow in the crowd who's a TV producer, and he says that with Peter's abilities, he can make him a fortune. He gives him his card and tells him that he'll be a smash on Ed Sullivan's show.
Yeah, I like the name drop, too.
Yeah.
So Peter takes that initial winning and decides he better up his showmanship and make himself an actual spider costume. So he comes up with his own design, and then he begins, being the science nerd that he is, building his web shooters.
Yeah, so he basically innovates most of the gadgetry that we associate with Spider-Man. He's got the cool red and black suit. He's got the airfoils under his armpits. He's got the web shooters that shoot the super sticky, super strong webs. And he is ready for show business.
I do like, right as he's ready, he says, okay, world, better hang on to your hat. Here comes the Spider-Man.
Part two. Peter Parker is a bona fide celebrity. He is doing all sorts of tricks. He's climbing up and down walls. He is, what is he doing? He's
He looks like he's putting a candle out with his web shooters.
I think
from
so.
Across a room.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's such a big feat, but he did it.
yeah, the crowd is just going crazy for it. As Peter goes back to his dressing room, he's being hounded by magazine reporters and movie talent scouts and journalists, and they all want a piece of him.
And the minute he gets free of all of that rabble, he encounters a thief running away from a police officer who begs him to stop him. And he just lets him walk by.
Yep. Because as Peter says to the cop, "Sorry, pal, that's your job. I'm through being pushed around by anyone. From now on, I just look out for number one. That means me."
And the cop says, "I ought to run you in." He says, "Save your breath, buddy. I've got things to do." So he's totally diva star mode now.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what are those things to do? Well, one of them is that he heads home, and Aunt May and Uncle Ben have gotten him that microscope that he's always had his eye on. Peter just loves them to death. He says they're the only ones who've ever been kind to him. He's going to make sure that they are always happy, but the rest of the world can go hang for all I care.
So then he proceeds to become a huge celebrity, continues becoming the sensation of the nation.
But one night, Peter Parker returns home from a personal appearance, and he sees police cars out in front of his home. And he gets the terrible news that Uncle Ben has been shot and murdered. A burglar broke into their house. Uncle Ben surprised him. He killed him in cold blood. The police officer tells Peter that they know where the burglar is. He's in the old Acme warehouse at the waterfront, and they'll get him. Peter's not so sure.
So he decides he better switch into his costume and go there himself.
And so we see Peter doing his first web swinging across the city. He winds up at the old warehouse. He slips into it unnoticed, and then does a really pretty good job of scaring the hell out of this guy, crawling down the wall at him. He's ready to just take out all of his rage and all of his frustration on the man who took his uncle away from him.
And so he uses his web shooter to take away the gun and then starts, well, I mean, it looks like he might just punch him once. And when he does, he knocks his hat off and he realizes that this is the same man he let run by when he was coming backstage after a television show.
And Peter says it's his fault. It's all his fault. If only he had stopped him when he could have, but he didn't. And now Uncle Ben is dead.
And that's where we hear this first, which many of us have heard many times in life. "And a lean, silent figure slowly fades into the gathering darkness, aware at last that in this world with great power, there must also come great responsibility."
That's an 11-page story. That's 2 pages less than Thor's origin.
It is so good.
Yeah. It's an amazingly efficient bit of comic storytelling. And we get a tease at the very end of the issue, encouraging us to be sure to see the next issue of Amazing Fantasy for the further amazing exploits of America's most different new teenage idol, Spider-Man. Spoiler alert, there is no next issue of Amazing Fantasy. This was the last issue. The only reason the story got published in the first place was because the book was about to be canceled. And Martin Goodman, the publisher, just said, do whatever you want, Stan. Yeah,
give it a shot.
Yep. So it would be, I believe, like 7 or 8 months before Spider-Man shows up again in his own book. But the response to this was amazing right off the bat. Whereas the origin of Thor is a little bit more ambiguous. Spider-Man, again, there's still some discrepancies between Steve Ditko's version of how he came to be and Stan Lee's version of how he came to be. But Stan basically has owned up to the fact that, well, this is a direct quote from Stan Lee talking about Steve Ditko, and I believe the foreword to a biography on Steve Ditko. "All I had to do was give Steve a one-line description of the plot, and he'd be off and running. He'd take those skeleton outlines I'd given him and turn them into classic little works of art that ended up being far cooler than I had any right to expect." They're both, both Stan and Steve are given equal co-creator credit, but there's a lot of both guys in the story. There's a lot of Ditko, But there's definitely, I mean, that prose at the very end is pure Stan Lee. Just sort of the extremely dramatic, weighty, classic literary prose style that Stan brought to comics.
Yeah, I don't know if you said this already, but there is the note from that Kirby was given the first crack at being the Spider-Man artist.
Yeah, that's right.
But mm-hmm. Stan thought his take on the character was too heroic, so you get Ditko, which is a much more human, and again, I don't know how to describe Ditko's art, paranoia and anxiety, yes, and other elements. You like, he really breathes that into the character, I think, in ways that Kirby wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to go with like a pure dichotomy, Jack is very much, you know, the extroverted, bombastic, huge momentum and drama, and Ditko's very, you know, a very introverted, internal character. He does a lot of work with, you know, shadows revealing interior frames of mind, things like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, just tension, anxiety, paranoia, all the stuff definitely comes through in Ditko's art. You know, another thing that kind of struck me is both of these stories are relatively the same length. And to fit all the Thor story in, Kirby had to use a lot of small panels. Well, Ditko had to also use a lot of small panels, but he's telling a more intimate story. He's telling a smaller story. Whereas I feel like Jack's Thor origin felt constrained in some ways. With Ditko's Spider-Man origin, it felt really appropriate to the character.
Yeah, it's a very human story on human scale, for
yes,
the most part. You know, even when he's hamming it up on the Ed Sullivan show or whatever, it still feels like he's a guy who just sort of got really lucky, and he's as excited about it as anybody would be. Whereas the Thor story seems like it should just be full splash pages of smashing aliens.
Yes. You know? But Jack was saving that for the 70s.
Yeah. Every page a splash page.
Well, let's jump into what we thought held up pretty well, and things that maybe didn't age so well. Just to kind of set this up, here's my take on it. I think basically everything from Spider-Man's origin is, again, just about as perfect as superhero comic books get. There's really nothing you can point to that could be improved upon in any way, as far as I'm concerned. Whereas I think that the Thor story does not hold up nearly as well as a story. I think the character winds up becoming great, especially once Kirby gets into more of the mythology of you know, the Norse gods and
Asgard,
Asgard and all that. But you know, up until this point, really, there's not a lot there. If I'd read both of these issues, you know, for the first time in the same month, I would have been wildly excited about Spider-Man and probably not as much about Thor.
No. Yeah, I would. There are a few things about Thor that struck me as interesting, but it's nothing about his origin.
Yeah.
And I'll cover on that a little bit later.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, I mean, like, just focusing on the Spider-Man origin. So, like, everything proceeds really logically in the story, which I think is something that is easy to overlook or underrate. I'm actually in the middle of reading a bunch of 1960s Justice League comics right now, mm-hmm. Which are, they're just not great, honestly. And a lot of it just comes out of this this attitude of, it doesn't have to make sense, we'll just keep throwing crazy stuff into the mix. Yeah. And I mean, there's definitely, that's its own type of fun. But where you have a story that just proceeds like in a very human and a very realistic way, and is also a really good superhero story, that's quite a trick to pull off. Like, Peter discovers his powers basically by accident, by reacting to something after he gets bit by the spider. He chooses to disguise himself, not because he's worried about his family's safety or anything like that, but because he doesn't want to embarrass himself if he screws up.
Right.
You know, he wants to use his powers to make money and be famous and be admired because he's a kid who's been kicked around his entire life. We don't know the reason, but, you know, I mean, he's being raised by his aunt and uncle, so there's something unfortunate in his backstory.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he becomes a hero because he had the opportunity to do a heroic thing and he chose to be selfish instead. And it cost him personally. And now he carries this guilt around and he has to atone for it for the rest of his life.
Like, yeah, it's a perfect origin.
Yeah. I love the fact that at literally every point in the story, and this sets the tone for the Spider-Man character, period.
Yes.
At every point, Peter's the underdog, and becoming Spider-Man solves absolutely none of his problems.
I love that as well. I mean, briefly, I think he has some money problems solved, but that's about it.
And it's such a strong story. Like this story, this literal exact story has been retold over and over and over again, you know, in a bunch of different comic books,
TV shows, cartoons.
Yeah. Cartoons, yeah. Movies, like and there's almost no changes. Like there are superficial modernization elements, you know, like now the spider's genetically engineered or, you know, because radiation doesn't work as a plot device as well. But yeah, I mean, there's no changes to it. And it just holds up so beautifully. I mean, I'm not even being hyperbolic when I say it's basically a Shakespearean story. Like it has all these elements, these archetypal elements. It makes it so human and so universal and so, so good.
I'd like to think that Stan was really pouring his heart into this one, which is why he threw the Thor story over to Larry.
I think you're right. So let's talk about Thor then. And, you know, much of the Thor stuff doesn't hold up as well.
Yeah, we covered on a lot of this, but the fact that his, you know, kryptonite is if he leaves his hammer laying around for 60 seconds, he goes back to frail Dr. Don Blake.
Yeah.
That's just not necessary.
Yeah, and it really comes out of that 60s Silver Age tradition of, you know, every superhero needs some gimmicky vulnerability, you know, because Superman has kryptonite, therefore, you know, Green Lantern's ring doesn't work on yellow things, or Martian Manhunter, you know, can't be around fire, or, you know, later on, Tony Stark has shrapnel moving toward his heart, so he has to plug himself into the wall, you know, every day to keep it from happening. You know, just like these, it's a gimmicky weakness. It doesn't arise naturally out of some flaw in the character, which I think is a great way to do a weakness.
Which is also Peter Parker.
Yeah, exactly.
He has every human weakness you can imagine. He's, you know, he seeks fame because he's been pushed around.
Yep.
He has anxiety about everything.
Yeah.
So he has his kryptonite is just being human.
Yeah.
Whereas Thor's kryptonite is just some plot device that is not super thought out.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, maybe if someone other than Larry Lieber had been scripting this, then maybe, you know, we would have gotten something a little more thoughtful. I don't know. I mean, I also don't want to throw Larry under the bus, although he did write the first appearance of Hank Pym. and that wasn't a super great story either. So, you know, at this point, you know, maybe he hadn't quite found his voice and his rhythm yet. He'll get more cracks at it. So,
Yeah. And then Thor, of course, doesn't become the Thor that I think really gained in popularity, the Thor that's more connected, as you said before, with Asgard and with the Norse gods and his whole becoming the actual god Thor, not a human frail dude riding around in the body of a god.
Exactly. And he doesn't even have that distinctive Shakespearean speech pattern that Stan winds up giving him once he takes over scripting the book, you know, the these and the thous and the hasts, and which just gives that character an added grandeur and or pompousness that is just, I mean, it really kind of takes it to the next level.
And
I
it
think.
Gets him. Yeah. It becomes almost not, it becomes a running joke of other characters having to like, you know, comment to each other, is this guy for real?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But yeah, so yeah. And even, you know, issues with the character aside, and, you know, the fact that some of his coolest stuff doesn't show up yet. Just the pacing of the story is not solid. Like Thor doesn't even arrive until halfway through a very short story. And then he spends way too much time figuring out his powers and defining them in these absurd levels of detail. The entire fight against the villains of the piece takes place in about 2 pages. And then they just kind of run off, and you don't hear from the Stone Men of Saturn again until years and years and years later. They're another, like the Toad Men, very forgettable alien race that, you know, they were almost one and done.
Although recently they have been, they've achieved some measure of fame with Korg.
Yes. Yep.
From the Thor Ragnarok movie and from the Planet Hulk storyline.
Yeah. So if you have seen Thor Ragnarok, and I'm betting a lot of you have, the stone fellow who is Thor's fellow gladiator friend, who's voiced by the Ragnarok director, Taika Waititi, he is in canon in the comics. He is one of these Stone Men of Saturn. He gets retconned into having been there when Thor first showed up. So that is the continuity through here. So I don't think it's enough to redeem the story necessarily, but no. I have to give him credit for reaching back into the depths of Marvel lore and pulling something out and polishing it up.
Yeah, I love, and that's another thing about the Marvel Universe is everything gets dusted off and polished up at some point,
yeah,
or used as a joke. But in this case, you know, Korg becomes a great character.
Oh, yeah.
A really interesting, funny, and strong character.
Yeah.
And in the, this is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe now, but, you know, still it's a wonder that this Easter Island Benjamin Grimm somehow and really the character in the movie doesn't look that different from what we see in this comic and from the 60s.
Yeah. So if we're each going to pick one panel from the comics that we read this month, what would you say would be your panel of the month to represent August 1962?
Well, mine is a little weird because the Spider-Man story is so great. But
yeah.
So I kind of like leaned towards looking for something in the Thor story. And what I came upon as I reread this was just this notion, like it suddenly hit me that in this one panel, there is a Norse god jumping into a scene over spaceships at alien rock men with a laser blaster. And it's just one little panel on page 11. It's the first panel, Thor the Mighty Strikes Back. And there's a few other things where he's like fighting the robot, but it's just this juxtaposition of Norse mythology with the science fiction of the day. And that's just another core component of the Marvel Universe. They will just mash up anything. I mean, we just had the Fantastic Four as pirates.
Right.
And it works. Like, they make it work, and it just becomes this quirky core thing. And it somehow, this just embodies that and typifies that to me. It's a perfect way to show how they're just willing to throw anything together, and it somehow works in the superhero universe they're building.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, not to mention the fact that, especially once Kirby hits his stride with Thor, any scenes of Thor leaping into action, especially in subsequent issues, you're just in for a treat. I mean, he's just got, you know, this giant hammer that's great for walloping. When Kirby just draws his enemies, you know, flying away from him like bowling pins.
Right.
It's awesome.
And the hammer, the way he shows the hammer, you know, hitting multiple things like that, those kinds of scenes have been picked up in cartoons tiny bit, but in the movies recently, almost perfectly. Like,
yeah,
you could tell they've been referencing these shots and scenes to make that happen. It's
absolutely
beautiful.
Yeah. Well, if I have to pick one panel, it would have to be from the Spider-Man story, and picking one panel out of that is just about impossible for me. They're all so good. I'm a huge Ditko fan. I think today, And this could absolutely change tomorrow, but I think I'm going to go with the first panel on page two. And this probably, you know, comes from, I'm a dad of a young kid. And I think just that panel of Uncle Ben tussling Peter's hair and waking him up, I think is just, it's such a fun and loving, affectionate illustration. And just in that one drawing gets across the loving relationship that they have. And it invests that relationship with the emotional depth that is necessary in order to make the reader feel Uncle Ben's loss by the end of the story. You know, Ditko's only got 11 pages to do this in. And so he starts laying some pretty heavy groundwork right on the second page. I mean, I just love it. I think it's a very beautiful little human touch. And probably something that, you know, didn't consciously strike me as being that important, you know, in my younger days. But definitely as I get older, like, that's the one that stands out to me.
Yeah, I would certainly have glossed right over that when I was younger, looking for more. Where's the costume? I used to draw Spider-Man obsessively. And I had a Spider-Man mask when I was in first grade for Halloween. You know, I have a long connection. I mean, and I currently have a pretty deep connection, as many of us geeks do, with the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
I have a, you know, Spider-Man pillow that sits in my living room. I have a cat that has a patch over one eye, so his name is Odin. and it goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the other core component of Peter Parker and Spider-Man that is shown in this panel is the love, the family love, I think, is what makes him again human, but also makes him not a villain.
Yes.
Like, to have this family that loves him helps ground him. And then, of course, to that loss. But in addition to that loss, the love he has, I think, shapes him as a person. So
yes.
I think that's a really important part of, again, what makes that story so great in such a short amount of pages and panels.
So we got to talk about how marvelous was the month. I think we're going to use a scale that comes straight out of Amazing Fantasy number 15. So, on a scale of 1 to 10 of Aunt May's famous wheat cakes, how marvelous was this month, Rob?
I want to say 10. I want to say a full stack. But, you know, the month also has Thor's sort of weak origin, too. So, I've got to back it down. Spider-Man is a 10. Thor knocks a couple off of that. So we're handicapped down to 8.5.
All right.
We're gonna 8.5 with a lot of syrup.
Yeah, that's still more than I could eat. You know, I hear where you're coming from. The Thor story was really underwhelming, especially when it had, you know, so many of the things I don't like about early Thor. Basically, you know, Don Blake.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it lacked the things that I really do love about Thor. But again, I think Spider-Man's origin is about as good as comic books ever got. So yeah, it's all downhill from here, unfortunately. But I'm going to give it a full stack of 10 because I think if you have any month where you can put out a story like that, it doesn't matter how bad the rest of the stuff might be. And Thor's not bad. It's just not good, you know? Yeah, I'm going to say it's a month that I have been looking forward to doing on this podcast for basically since we started it. I'm really, really happy that we got to do it.
And we have these stars in the Marvel Universe now, too. That's like, I think of each of these little blips as a star in the sky. And this is Spider-Man is a very bright star.
Absolutely. So we are now up to the Fantastic Four. We have Henry Pym, we have the Hulk, we have Thor, and we got Spider-Man. That's a pretty good little universe we got going on.
Yeah, and next week we're going to visit all of them.
Yep. Pretty awesome. Thanks for tuning in to yet another episode of Marvel by the Month. If you want to find us on the social medias, you can find us on Instagram at Marvel by the Month, on Twitter at Marvel BTM, on Facebook at facebook.com/Marvel by the Month, and drop us an email sometime at marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. You can also visit us on a website that is called marvelbythemonth.com. I think that's it.
That is it.
Thanks again for listening. I have been Brian Stratton.
And I have been Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.